The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the Buddha said that there are different functions of a Dharma talk, of lectures, discussions about Dharma. And the first kind would be a kind of instructional. And that's usually what mindfulness, insight, vipassana teachers are doing. It's sort of instructions. It's instructions about how to approach our experience, how to work with what arises in the body and mind. The kinds of behaviors that are conducive towards happiness, the ways we untangle ourselves from the causes of suffering. And so they're pretty methodical and instructional. And then there's another kind of Dharma talk that's just meant to gladden the mind. You know, it's like it's really intense being human, and we can benefit from just gladdening the mind. And over time, the Dharma feels more and more like a refuge and brings more and more gladness, delight to the mind. And just that, even if we learned nothing, just gladdening the mind is a useful thing to do. One of my friends and a teacher has been talking all about pleasure, you know, and sukha and delight in practice. And it came out of his realization that we need that. Our bodies and minds need that. We need to marinate in pleasure, like to do this work. It can't be just digesting suffering all the time. You know? And so to kind of refuel and invigorate ourselves, it's really good just for the mind to be gladdened. And then the last kind of talk is meant to encourage or support people in their practice. There's a general tendency of practitioners to feel like they're doing it wrong. That's almost universal, especially at the beginning. It's like everyone thinks they must be doing it wrong. And maybe that fades away, but then at some point they get to a point in practice, a phase where it feels like things have gotten completely off track and there's no way this is the path. Do you know that feeling? Like there's no way this is what the Buddha's asking me to do. There's no, that must be wrong. And in those moments, it can be helpful to be supported in some way. Now, I think a lot of insight teachers are kind of technicians, and instructional in nature. But it's helpful sometimes to reflect on the fruits of practice. And for the fruits of practice to be not kind of like dangled or something as some big prize or something like that, or something against which we judge our practice, or how much we've grown or anything like that, but just to know that there are we underestimate the capacity of the heart. There are some teachers who really only talk about fruits. They never talk about method. They just talk about outcomes. And maybe this testifies to the faith that if we keep going, you know, if we keep improvising and making effort, that'll take care of itself. So I wanted to talk about some of the fruits of practice tonight. Hopefully be supportive in your efforts. So, and one thing I've seen in practitioners is that over time, over the months and years of practice, our behavior comes into closer alignment with our intentions. There's always that gap, right? We all know that gap between intention and behavior, right? That gap, maybe it never goes away fully, completely. I don't know. But it can get a lot smaller, yeah? And it can get a lot smaller specifically in the realm of sila, of conduct, of how we treat one another, of our intention towards non-harming. And the Buddha talked about the bliss of blamelessness. And maybe that sounds like too much or idealized or something, blamelessness. But maybe you get a sense of the kind of the ease of feeling like one's conduct is in alignment with what we care about. Something happens when we're out of step with our deepest intentions. It's like the heart kind of has to close a little bit when we're out of step with that. And over time, we come into more and more alignment with it. And it's like our sila, our conduct, takes less and less effort. At first, it feels like conduct, you know, like we hear ethics and morals, and you sort of hear like we feel like kids being told to be good. And it feels like, okay, I'll have to sacrifice something to be good. It's a trade-off, yeah. And over time, I think it's less and less like that. Wholesome behavior feels like less and less of a sacrifice. We feel less and less conflicted. And this is a way, I think, of making our past kind of whole, of integrating our past, of making sense of our past in light of the Dharma, of feeling like the Dharma begins to touch, is the framework for our understanding of ourselves. And it means that there's no part of our life, there's no memory, there's no conduct that feels outside of the eye of the Dharma. And there's a lot of completeness, yeah, wholeness that arises out of that. Because we don't, you know, we don't feel so fragmented. And whatever's been difficult in our life has been digested enough that it doesn't have as much power to, old suffering doesn't have as much power to create new suffering. And if we look, if we open to our life, to our past, to our behavior, there aren't those soft spots of those sensitive places of pain. It's like they've arisen enough in our practice. They've been touched with enough wisdom and care that there are fewer and fewer soft spots in our history. There's no more question about practice. No more deliberation or anxiety about how much we're doing or not doing. There's no more sense of kind of doubt about the value of practice. And so in, you know, a lot of times in a Dharma life, we come to, we get into these questions like, is this the right, am I doing it right? Can I do it? Am I doing enough? Yeah. And that just, that whole anxious tangle starts to resolve itself. And our whole life becomes the path and practice. At this point, I think the path really feels like it's ours. Not like we're walking the Buddha's path. It feels like, you know what? I am creating a path. I'm not walking some other path. And it feels very, very personal. Personal in a way so that even if the Buddha and this whole beautiful tradition never existed, we'd still want to be on that path. We'd still want to be walking it. We would still not be mired in doubt. And all the questions about our capacity, that just really quiets down. We're not perfect in practice at all, but there's no... there's no ambivalence anymore. It's like the heart feels in alignment with Dharma. And it's just the path showing up in a million ways. And with this, there's a real sense of safety of, you know, when that soaks into us, like everything is path. And when we know that it literally all has a place, it's relieving for the heart. A Koban Chino, a Zen teacher, says, the more you sense the rareness and value of your own life, the more you realize that how you use it, how you manifest it, is your responsibility. We face such a big task, so naturally such a person sits down for a while. We also start to become more realistic about what can and can't bring us happiness. Something that came up in the Q&A. There's a whole body of psychological research on affective forecasting, which is a really kind of nice way of talking about how well we can predict our emotional response at a later point, you know, in response to some event or something. And as it turns out, we're not too good at predicting. And this is a guess, but my sense is that actually with more and more mindfulness practice, we become better affective forecasters. We actually have a deeper sense of what can and can't work for us in our lives. The other finding that comes out of that literature is that we tend to underestimate our resilience. You know? And as more and more of life feels like path, there's more trust in our resilience. There's a kind of confidence in the heart's capacity to open to life. As we tend to come to in this process of being realistic about what can and can't do it for us, generally we come to want less, which means that we're lacking less. And as our desires get simpler, our life gets simpler. It's complicated to want things. It just requires a lot of scheming, you know, just to get like a burrito is like, there's a lot that has to happen. And when you add up all those different desires we have, you know, it feels complicated. It feels complicated. Now, we can't and shouldn't get rid of that or something, but as we want less and less, it's simpler to live. Yeah. As practice unfolds, we generally come to think about ourselves less. You know, it's not that we're neglectful of ourself or something like that, but it takes less and less energy to like keep the system running. It still, I think, takes energy. But the sense of being in this incredibly intricate labyrinth of life, trying to find stay away from the wall of pain and move towards pleasure and just hunker down, and that whole experience starts to change. And because there's less and less energy that's being put into the self system, naturally the attention just opens to others. So this teacher, a monk, Ajahn Sumedho from the Thai forest tradition, who's taught a bit, is no longer really teaching. I think he's in Thailand now, but was the abbot of a couple monasteries for decades. And I don't know when he said this, but it was deep into his meditation life, and he's known as being free and in at least in a lot of spheres and quite satisfied with his life. And so it was a little context for his comment that he said, every time I think about myself, I get depressed. I've even heard one of his students and colleagues, Ajahn Amaro, say the word, he just said, like, I. And he commented about how it starts to sound weird. It's definitely heavy when you're just like, me, mine. Yeah. This is related to our, not to, to giving up self-care, but giving up self-clinging. You know? That this habit of sensing like there's some center of gravity in the middle of our being that is self, that's the Matthew inside of Matthew, that this is illusion and the cause of a lot of complication. And the way I talk about it sometimes is that if I gave you the assignment of carrying a very large and very precious and very fragile vase up to the city, and you had to walk to San Francisco carrying that vase. It was like a big vase, priceless. That trip up to the city gonna feel pretty constricted. Yeah? Gonna miss a lot. And naturally it breeds suspicion and vigilance. But we're protecting a phantom. There's nothing that actually needs us to stand guard. And as we begin to put down that vase more and more, life just has a sense of openness. Life feels safer. Our inner life feels safer. in all of this, the poignancy of being human starts to break the heart open. This is the convergence of wisdom and love. That as we really, as we see more and more what it's like to be human, as we sit and really open to what it's actually like, not what our ideas are, not what we think it should be like, not what it used to be like or what it might be like, but when we really open, like, what is it like to be human? And we ask that question again and again, and we meet the answer with less and less defensiveness. As we do this, it can't help but break the heart open. The seeing itself nourishes love. And they feel inextricably bound, wisdom and love. And the necessity of a path with heart. As is said, a path with heart. The necessity of this it becomes unquestioned. We, you could say, relinquish all hope for a close-hearted happiness. And that means we're going to have to explore what it's like to be open. But in living this way, we won't miss our life. John Kabat-Zinn quoted this this executive who worked really diligently for a long time, and the person said, I think she said, 10 years ago, I turned my cheek for a moment. And it became my life. I was so touched by that can happen. We can turn our cheek for a moment, and that can become a week, a month, 10 years. So we stay here. And I think it makes it less and less likely that we'll feel incomplete when our life closes. So let's just sit for a moment. So please take whatever feels useful and investigate and leave everything else behind. May whatever goodness is you can sense tonight here together, whatever goodness is in the room here, may this remind you of your goodness. And may whatever goodness, joy, ease, well-being that is yours, may this spill out in all directions in your life. May our lives be a cause for more joy, less suffering. Thank you for your practice. Nice to be with you.